Greetings, Earth explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived the disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. And they have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. Welcome to X Squared Radio, Earth Explorers. We're coming to you live from Eastern Washington State, up against the Canadian border, and we're so glad that you're here with us tonight. Our AccuWindow forecast is about 76 degrees, windy, of course, slightly cloudy. The solar wind tonight is 417.4 kilometers per second, proton count kind of low. It's okay to get out in the sun. The sun is quiet with little sunspot 999 left over from solar cycle 23 resting silently as the sun rotates. A solar wind stream flowing from a coronal hole should reach Earth on or about June 25th. Good chance for an aurora borealis that night. Are we living in the last century of our civilization? Is it possible that all of our technology, knowledge, and wealth cannot save us from ourselves? Could our society actually be heading toward collapse? According to many of the world's top scientists, the answer is yes. Well, maybe, unless we take action now. This September in Earth 2100, a dramatic ABC News two-hour broadcast, the greatest minds across the globe will join together in a countdown to the year 2100 to tell us what we must do to survive the next century and what may happen if we don't. The 21st century is going to be the century which determines whether we live or die as a sustainable species. As populations grow, as our use of resources grows, perhaps we will get closer and closer to that edge. In fact, in this talk show host's opinion. Maybe the human race has been here many times before, and we haven't made it. Back in 1962, recalls John Turtle, I was at Bird Station. That's 80 degrees south, 120 west, as part of the United States Antarctic Research Program. The station was housed in large tunnels under the snow's surface. One day in June, he emerged from a tunnel hatch and witnessed a breathtaking phenomenon. Hanging in the sky, there was a great white luminous cross with the moon in the middle. Now, he wasn't sure if he should drop to his knees or run for his camera. Fortunately, he ran for his camera, and he took a picture with his Nikon reflex camera on slide film. And I've seen the picture, and it is quite stunning what he saw when he came up out of the ice. You can imagine what he felt after being down in that cold tunnel for so long and then coming up and seeing that sight. By the way, at that time of year, there really is no sundown event. Kind of interesting. There is a 52-year-old who was suffering from advanced skin cancer, and he's now free from tumors within 8 weeks of undergoing a revolutionary gene therapy procedure. After 2 years, he is still free from the disease, which had spread to his lymph nodes and one of his lungs. Doctors took cells from the man's own defense system that were found to attack the cancer cells best, cloned them, and injected them back into his body in a process known as immunotherapy. Experts said that the case could mark a landmark in the treatment of cancer. Genetically altered white blood cells have been used before to treat cancer patients, but this is the first study to show that simply growing vast numbers of the few immune cells in the body to attack a cancer can be safe and effective. Although the technique is complex and difficult to use for all but a few patients, the principle that someone's own immune cells can be expanded and made to work in this way is very encouraging for the work that Cancer Research UK and others are carrying out. Just a couple more items here. Scientists have figured out the mysterious white substance unearthed by NASA's Phoenix lander on Mars. It's frozen water. The breakthrough came last week when Phoenix's stereo camera caught the substance in the act of disappearing. Bathed in Martian sunlight for 4 days, the white substance sublimated. That is to say, it evaporated. It didn't melt to water first and then evaporate. It went straight from solid to gas. This is how water behaves on Mars. Atmospheric pressure on the red planet is so low, about 1% of that of Earth. It rarely allows water to exist in liquid form on the planet's surface. Solid and gas are the only options. And it's kind of interesting. It could also have been frozen CO2, except that at this particular time, the Phoenix landing site is too warm for dry ice, which is frozen CO2. The average daily temperature is a balmy minus 70 degrees F. I've seen it colder than that in North Dakota. So not so bad. We could probably make it with a couple of mittens and an oxygen bottle. We could make it just fine. Last week, we had open lines with some amazing phone calls and studies about new energy. This was a follow-up of the Joe LaStella rebroadcast of October 28, 2007. Joe is the world record holder with electric cars, high-mileage vehicles, and is the president of the nation's most advanced biodiesel project. They are getting ready to launch the nation's first large-scale algae oil plant in Salt Lake City. This week, we have an outstanding opportunity to discuss the work of Anne Druffel. She is the author of 6 books on the subject of UFOs and the experts who have researched them. She has dedicated a lifetime to informing the people about the reality that planet Earth contains more than one sentient race and that our government knows much more than it is sharing with us. Please welcome with me Anne Druffel. How are you, Anne?
Just fine, thank you. It's very warm down here. was 106 again. But that's all right.
Well, that's the opposite end of Mars, almost just as inhospitable without air conditioning.
Yes.
Well, Anne, your book Firestorm is the book I read, and it was a great read and full of the most incredible details on the dedication of James McDonald's fight for UFO science. How did you get interested in writing this book?
Well, James McDonald was a famous atmospheric physicist who joined the UFO research field, the civilian UFO research field, in 1968. And in his work involved with atmospheric physics, he would travel around the world, you know, I mean around the country and around Canada and Australia, other places like that. And he would meet with us, you see. We were a subcommittee of NICAP here in Los Angeles at that time, the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. And so we got to know him personally. He was a very sociable man, and he loved to meet with us, and we loved him. And then I got a chance to archive his UFO files in the 1990s. I knew his widow, and she gave me permission to archive them, which I did with a grant from the Fund for UFO Research. And then during the archiving, I went to Tucson there six times to do that. And during the archiving, she expressed an interest, you know, in having a book written about it. And of course, that's the interest I had too. And we got together, and with her help, I was able to write Firestorm. May I correct something? I have written six books, but three of them are about UFOs. The others are about other paranormal subjects.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm going to read all six.
Okay.
And I suggest all of our listeners do that, too. You can't have enough information, especially from fine documentary writers. There's a lot of inflammatory and misleading things being written out there, and I've come across quite a few of it myself, but this book was just really, really well done. Now, James was something of a genius, but unlike most geniuses I know, he could focus his great intellect on a single issue for extended periods. How did most people respond to this ability of his?
Well, he had many colleagues who admired him deeply in the University of Arizona at Tucson. And, you know, some of them would try to say, you're a genius. They called him Mac. We called him Jim. They'd say, you're a genius, Mac. And he would shove away the word genius. He would not accept it. He said that he was interested in certain subjects, but don't call him a genius. And so I think he was close to a genius, which is what the colleagues that I interviewed for the book came to the conclusion that he was at least close to a genius. He was able to concentrate on several things at once, though, you see. He concentrated on problems of climatology and meteorology, and then when he developed an interest in the UFOs, he also concentrated on that.
Well, it makes sense.
But he would concentrate, you know, on various things at the same time.
I was going to say, it makes sense that someone who watches the sky with such, you know, interest and such science behind it, like why do clouds do that? Why does weather form this way? Why does the jet stream move and winds blow? Someone who watches the sky that much eventually would become interested in things that fly in it.
He did not develop an interest until he saw one himself. He came down from Chicago, Illinois, in 1954 to help found the Institute for Atmospheric Physics at the University of Arizona at Tucson. And when he was traveling with five other scientists south toward a southern town in Arizona, they saw something in the sky, in the western sky, and all six of these scientists saw it, could not understand what it was. It was an orb of light, you know, that behaved strangely. And of course, Jim, with his mind, after he got home to Tucson, he tried to figure out what it was, and he figured out it was not It was not Venus. It wasn't anything that he could understand as being in the sky, as having to be in the sky, you know, normally. And so he sent his report to the Project Blue Book, which he had learned about. And they wrote him back a very nice letter saying, you know, we appreciate very much your very intelligent sighting of this, and we will see what we can do. We will investigate it. And he never heard back from them. And this piqued his interest. Why did not Project Blue Book, which was an official study of the U.S., of the U.S. Air Force on UFOs, you know, presumably, why did they not get back to him? And so this started his interest in UFOs. And by 1958, he was working actively with the NICAP, whose headquarters were in Washington, D.C. It was a civilian research group organization. And but it was secret at first. He didn't want people to know that, you know, that he was researching UFOs with a civilian group. But by 1966, he came out openly because he felt he had to.
Well, that's a long time. I mean, that's 8 years. So obviously mm-hmm. James was not given to whims or outlandish behaviors, right?
Oh, my goodness, no. No, he was a most cautious scientist. I mean, all scientists are cautious, but Jim was more cautious than most scientists. He explored every aspect of everything that he studied, in climatology, meteorology, UFO research. He would study very, very carefully each little aspect.
Well, it's interesting that he is so cautious, and yet, well, I mean, I can tell you one of the things that can spell disaster for any mainstream scientist, even today, is the mention that UFOs are going to be the subject of a study on their particular work. I mean, investors run for the hills when UFOs are mentioned.
So exactly. We have scientists who work with our mutual UFO network, LA group here. And they cannot come out openly unless they're retired, you see. Once they retire, they can express their interests publicly. But as long as they're working in a college or, you know, under a government grant or anything like that, they have to be very, very cautious regarding their interest in the UFO research and their help with the civilian research groups here.
Well, I belong to a couple of astronomy clubs, and I can tell you when we go out for a dark sky event, they, besides telling you you can't turn any lights on while you're out there, they tell you there's no talking about UFOs out here, okay? This is just, we're just astronomers, and everyone knows there's no such thing as UFOs.
They caution you that.
Yeah, they do. I mean, before we go out, we're not going to hear of it, and if you start talking about it, you're going to get in your car and you're going to leave. But that's today. What was the atmosphere when James discovered the existence of UFOs in 1954?
Well, he didn't discover the existence of UFOs. He was very, very curious about what he had seen in 1954 together with a group of five other scientists, you see. This was broad daylight. He saw his sighting. But he did not. I'm sorry, I forgot the question.
Well, my question was, you know, the atmosphere today is one of, you know, Star Wars and nothing but fiction and video games that has to do with UFOs. Certainly, nothing rooted in what would be considered real science. But in 1954, 1958, when James had his UFO experience, it must have, you know, been something so profound he just could not leave it alone. And you know, he just didn't dismiss it and say, gee, that was strange, and I better never talk about it in public. It became the focus of his life, just about.
Well, it was a focus of part of his life. You see, he was a very famous, influential, worldwide known scientist of atmospheric physics. He was just a top scientist. And so UFOs were one of the things he was interested in. But of course, he had several grants from certain government agencies to conduct climatology and meteorology experiments and studies. And so he had to concentrate on that because that was his living. He had six children and a wife, you know. He had to make a living in science.
Exactly.
So his UFO research was a part of his life that some of his colleagues knew about, you know, early on before 66. But then in 1966, he was one of the first prominent scientists to come out openly wondering what UFOs might be. He never reached any firm conclusion. He had a very tentative hypothesis after several years that they were possibly visitors from outer space. But it was a very tentative hypothesis until the end of his life.
Well, in studying his papers and in talking to people that knew him besides yourself, did he ever tell you why he made it such a public thing? I mean, why didn't he just study in private the way most closet ufologists do? We don't tell people we're going to a MUFON meeting. We just go.
He had come to the conclusion that the question of UFOs was a serious scientific question that was being badly neglected by the scientific community. And this is what he concentrated on all of his talks, on all of his papers. It was a serious scientific question that was being badly neglected by the scientific community. And he gave hundreds of talks before the most influential scientific groups on the subject of UFOs. And this had never happened before. No scientist had ever had the courage to come out openly like that. But Jim was a very courageous man. He didn't consider himself courageous. He just considered himself a scientist.
Right.
And a serious scientific question has to be explored.
That's the way I feel, too. But I see in my scientific circles, I see data tossed out all the time because it doesn't fit the paradigm of the scientist that happens to be working on the project at the time.
Exactly.
But almost invariably, on down the road, the very data that they threw out becomes extremely significant, even in the subject that they're working in. So, you know, I, like James, I just wonder, you know, how did the experts of the day respond to things like radar validation or the lack of any known flying craft in the area of a sighting? Did they just say, well, I don't care what you say, it was swamp gas?
Well, Jim, of course, was always searching for scientific proof, which he never got, you know, of the existence of UFOs. But he did collect a lot of what he called empirical data. And most of these were from sightings which involved military pilots and military people on the ground who saw the same strange object in the sky, and also that it was caught on radar on the pilot's plane up in the sky and caught on radar at the same time on the ground. And these are what he called the radar visual cases, the RV cases, he called them, which he considered empirical data that there were unidentified objects flying around the sky. And this is what he concentrated on in his talks, the empirical data he was able to collect. And he had the scientific community, a lot of the people in the scientific community were beginning to see that this was a question, and they would listen very carefully to Jim McDonald. And one of the large scientific groups actually formed a committee for the study of UFOs because of his influence. And this happened around 1967, 68, 69. And then things began to happen that indicated to me and to most of the people in the UFO field that there was a government cover-up and that there was government interference going on against Jim McDonald's work. And once he died in 1971 under strange circumstances, the interest in the scientific community vanished.
Sure, right. To kill the leader or get him out of the way or obfuscate him in some way, and then the momentum is lost. I was going to ask, respective to government participation, the Air Force, the United States Air Force, believes that we own the skies, at least over our country and maybe around the entire world. How did the Air Force respond? I mean, did they make it possible for pilots to report these sightings?
Never. They reported them to the Project Blue Book, you see, which was the official in, quotes, a government study. And the pilots, the military pilots, had the permission to report their sightings to Project Blue Book. But the very important cases, Project Blue Book did not put in their files. They hid them away in classified files. And some of these were so classified that they went up further into God knows where. But they are still there in the hands of the government. And these are ones that the research committee has never been able to touch, particularly the photographs that that were taken, things that we don't even know about.
Well, they had to be really incredible. I've seen some amazing photographs, and I took two photographs myself. I had never seen a UFO till I was 52 years old, and then I saw one at night, and then the next year I saw two more during the day, and I photographed them, and just so I wasn't crazy, there was another woman standing next to me. I don't remember what her name was. She was photographing at the same time, and she got the same craft on her camera at the same time. So that's two cameras, two photographers at the same time catching the same craft. Now that was amazing.
Have these been given to the UFO community?
No, analyze? I'm afraid to talk about UFOs in public. I'm kidding.
Oh.
No,
we would love to analyze. I mean, if they have not been analyzed, computer enhanced, we would love to work with you on that.
Oh yeah, I'd like to share them. I can recommend one place if you want to go. It's the hottest UFO hotbed in the country, as far as I know, and that's James Gilliland's place outside of Trout Lake, Washington, at the base of Mount Adams. That place is unbelievable. It's just hopping all the time. Everybody that I know that goes there comes away and says, wow, I saw this, I saw that.
I've always wanted to go there.
Well, it's inexpensive and not too far away. Listen, according to James's calculations, and he was pretty good about interviewing his sightings, that people would have a sighting and he would find out about it, he'd go and interview them, and they would say, well, I saw it right there above the roof of the house and I was standing right here, and he would calculate how high these craft would have to be flying to be illuminated at that time of night. So how high would some of these craft be spotted flying?
Oh, all sorts of heights. But Jim was interested only in what he called close encounters of the first kind, which are within 500 feet of the witness, you see.
Wow.
Close encounters of the second or third kind, within 500 feet of the witness. These are the ones he concentrated on, because those are the ones that can be triangulated more accurately.
Sure.
We do triangulation here too. We use the same methods about figuring out how big the thing possibly was and how high it was and how fast it was going by triangulation methods. And this is what he used too. But he did not concentrate on the ones that were seen very, very high in the sky or that did not perform unusual movements. He knew which ones might be conventional, and he, you know, he didn't brush them off, but he, you know, just put them in a file saying possible identification like we do.
Well, we've gone out dark sky events, and we'll hit heavensabove.com, and it has a list of all the satellites that are going to come over your particular zip code that night and what time they're going to come over and how bright they're going to be. And we'll make a list, and then we go out with our little red flashlights, and we do a dark sky event. And we've been standing out there and seeing literally one or two craft every 2 or 3 minutes for hours going overhead. And there just aren't that many satellites up there.
My goodness, that's wonderful. I know that Jim would have loved to be with you.
he would have come
up there to be with you.
I would ordinarily say that they're satellites. You know, they're gold in color, and they seem to be going about, I don't know, 18,000 miles an hour going around the planet. But it seems so strange when you take a few green lasers and you aim up at the thing to show people where it is tracking along, and then the thing just turns white. I mean, just goes from a dull gold color to just lightning bright and expands to 6 or 7 times its size. That's really spine tingling to see that happen.
So that would not be a satellite set up by some country that is a secret satellite. They would not do anything like that, would they?
Well, you know, Heavens
Even
Above
it was one that
prides
was
themselves
not known about.
On tracking every single thing in the sky, but they admit there's one satellite that the U.S. has launched, and they can't find it. It must be black or something. It doesn't reflect light. And they have not been able to find it. They know generally when it was launched, what the trajectory was, and satellites are not equipped with the ability to move themselves across the sky very much. They pretty much have to travel the path they're set on.
Exactly.
And they have not been able to find this satellite. Evidently, it's a super secret surveillance satellite, and they just haven't been able to find it.
Well, thank God we have things like that.
Well, I hope so. I hope they're not nefarious in any way and about doing good things for the planet, but I have my doubts. One of my high school buddies...
Well, okay. I'm with you on that, too.
One of my high school buddies went to work for Hughes. I went in the Air Force, and he went to work for Hughes Satellite, worked for him for 18 years, and all of those GPS satellites and TV satellites, like DirecTV and all that, he put all those satellites up there. But he said that's only a small fraction of the satellites that they put up, and some of them he can't talk about. They're just surveillance satellites with unbelievable capabilities. Not too many months ago, we shot one out of the sky for fear that it was going to come back to Earth with some of the optics intact.
Yes.
And it makes me wonder, you know, is there that much interesting on the Earth to be looking at, or are some of these satellites out there trying to pick up information coming from somewhere else?
Oh, all right. Information about things coming in from outer space.
Yeah, right. I mean, we have
I would hope that they're doing that
out there, but you know, maybe there are other methods of detection that we have that sweep space. It's amazing the things that sneak out. There used to be a channel on satellite TV called the NASA channel. It's still up there, but it doesn't do what it used to do. It used to run the feed from the camera underneath the space station as it went around the planet. And it was a really neat wallpaper. You could kind of put it up on your big screen TV and just watch Earth go by underneath the space station, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, one day somebody was running their TiVo, and The space station was crossing over the Andes Mountains down in South America, and up through the clouds comes this, what looks to be 2 or 3 mile in diameter craft, comes up through the clouds and goes sailing across the top of the clouds at about 50,000 feet and goes on out into space.
Uh-huh.
And the guy caught it on his TiVo. So he sent it out across the net, and I never heard another word about that. And shortly thereafter, that feed from the space station ended.
Oh my goodness. I wonder if that's what's called a carrier craft. They appear about every 5 or 6 years off the coast here, off of San Diego, Los Angeles.
Really?
And they're aggregations of smaller craft, and usually they're cloud shrouded around here anyway, and then the smaller craft in them come and make forays inland, and they are seen by many witnesses. But we have several very well investigated events like that occurring every 5 or 6 years around here. But that sounds like a carrier craft, maybe, that...
Oh, this thing was big.
It came from the earth, did it?
Yeah, it came up from the earth through the clouds and went out into space, like it had lifted off from somewhere in the Andes Mountains.
Was that because it was being surveillanced by one of our satellites?
I don't know. I don't know. Maybe it was just a normal egress from the planet, and it just happened to be caught on film by the space station.
Oh, my.
But
I wish the government would give us, you know, would share this information with us. That they say that that maybe the government doesn't share information with the public because they're afraid that we would become afraid. But Americans don't panic. We, you know, we didn't panic when 9/11 happened.
Well, I don't think any other society would either. I mean, you know, if you've ever been
so either.
You've been to Europe and looked at any of the art galleries, even Christian art going way back 500-600 years, there are UFOs right in the paintings.
Exactly.
I don't think they had near the problem with off-world craft as we do. And at the time, at least to my knowledge, there were no Earth-made flying machines in those days.
Well, no. Maybe these things were just seen in relationship to the religious event that was depicted in the picture, and they put the thing in there not knowing what it was.
Right.
You know,
and,
it may be that
nowadays,
they didn't even recognize that it might be what we call a UFO from outer space.
Nowadays, we wouldn't think anything about it. We would say, oh, gee, that's nothing more than a UFO. But in those days, it was divine. So who's to say angels or ancient gods didn't travel by some kind of craft? Not saying they had to fly between worlds in a tin can, but maybe they have a craft that's capable of you know, transversing dimensions or distances, like in a way we don't understand.
I know that that's one of the theories that researchers have presented over the years. I think of UFOs as physical, unidentified craft of various shapes and sizes, but
right.
that they would not contain angels, you know, who would travel in their own way, but would contain some kind of physical, intelligent beings from elsewhere.
Right. That you and I both are on the same page there. But when you're talking about a person that still rubs two sticks together to make fire, he would appear to be an angel.
Ah, all right. All right.
Now, I remember as a kid, there was a television program called, it was called Project Blue Book, I think. It was kind of like Dragnet for UFO sighting investigations by the Air Force. I think it lasted one or two seasons. But how did the public in those days, back in the 60s, really treat this Project Blue Book? Did they believe in it? Did they think the Air Force was being thorough?
We considered that it was very possibly, you know, okay, and that they were collecting sightings from military people and from, you know, other sources that were not available to us. But it wasn't until Jim McDonnell entered the field that we began to suspect highly that Project Blue Book was holding classified information, and that even the highly classified information wasn't even held in the classified files of Project Blue Book, but was going someplace else. Jim helped us understand that.
Well, kind of interesting. Nick Pope is the, he's retired now, but he was in the Ministry of Defense for UK. And he was recently on Larry King Live. I had him on this program about a year and a half ago and asked him questions about the UFO archives and how things are reported in the UK and whether or not he believed that there were craft or not. And he actually said he really didn't believe that there were craft, although there were things that were unexplainable. But on Larry King Live about a month and a half ago, he said, you know, even if you go through all of the database of everything you find in UFOs, there's no proof that they exist. So
there is no scientific proof, no.
Right,
Jim was never able to find it. We have never been able to find scientific proof, but we do have the empirical evidence that, that Jim and other people have gathered, that there are physical unidentified craft being caught on radar, chased by jet pilots, and seen by multiple witnesses on the ground, and in aircraft. These are the ones that we consider to be the most solid sightings.
Well, who was running Project Blue Book in 1966?
Oh, dear. It was someone that Jim didn't like, I know. Didn't get along. Oh, I can't remember the name.
The
first time that Jim went to Blue Book, it was he made the three visits to Blue Book, and the first time he went, he got in an argument with the head of the Blue Book. I could look it up who it was, but after that. He did his best. He would go and he would work with, you know, whoever was kind enough of the three-person committee in Blue Book. The three people were on the staff, and that they would let him see some of the sightings that he requested. He would learn about sightings that were of interest because of he had heard about them from various sources, and he would go to Blue Book and try to find them in the files. And he would find some of them, and then he would find that very interesting sightings the UFO research field, the civilians, had researched thoroughly, and we were convinced that there was, you know, that they were good sightings, unidentified. He would look them up in the Blue Book files, and he would find that they had been classified by the expert who at the time was J. Allen Hynek. He was the scientific consultant for Blue Book. J. Allen Hynek had said meteor, you know, or, you know, some other climatology explanation that Jim knew that these sightings were not explainable by. And so that's how he got involved with Dr. Hynek the first time he went to Blue Book. And he found out that Dr. Hynek was, assigning these conventional explanations to these very good sightings. He went to Chicago to Blue Book, Hynek's office at his university there, and he pounded on his desk and he said, "Why do you do this?" And that was his first meeting with J. Allen Hynek.
What an introduction. Well, let's talk about...
What an introduction, because J. Allen Hynek, you know, years afterwards, he was a very kind man, and we worked with him after he left Blue Book. He turned into an objective scientist that was very, very helpful to the field, as you know.
Well, it's kind of hard to go against your civil servant salary if it's putting your kids through college and keeping your...
Exactly, Exactly. That's the explanation that J. Allen Hynek gave Jim. You know, that he had to make money to send his kids through college. And but of course, Jim McDonald did not accept this.
Let's talk about one of the major sightings. Air Force Major Rudolph Pestalozzi filed a case about an encounter of a B-36 with two UFOs. He witnessed this encounter with two other people from the ground. But can you describe this event for us? What did Major Rudolph Pestalozzi file?
I'm not acquainted with that.
Well, there was about 5 minutes where two UFOs toyed with a B-36, and they had a 10-man crew inside the aircraft, and they would move from side to side, watching out the windows as these craft passed them three or four times their speed without making a sound and without disrupting the airflow around their craft. And evidently, Major Pestalozzi witnessed this from the ground. They actually watched it happen. So you had ground confirmation, air confirmation, and they filed this case with Blue Book, and James McDonald interviewed them and then tried to put the pieces together and find out what really happened. What did they see?
So is that in Firestorm? Because,
Firestorm.
You know, once you write a book, some of the information goes out of your head as you start to write another book.
The name
of the sighting sounds familiar, but the details are such as you describe have gone out of my mind. I'm sorry.
Well, it's a great book. It's 500 pages. How could you commit it all to memory, even if you wrote it? But the bottom line is that you know. Do we know of any way that a craft could move through the air without creating turbulence of some kind of wake that would, you know, upset the flying characteristics of the aircraft? And really, the only member of this 10-man crew of this B-36 that did not see the craft very well was the pilot, and that's because he couldn't get out of his chair and go back and look out the windows.
Oh, my. Well, you see, that would be considered a sighting with empirical data, empirical evidence. And that's why Jim was interested in it, because of the multiple sightings from different sources at the same time.
Well, to your knowledge, were there any aircraft that we were working on or anyone was working on at that time that could perform that way?
Not in Jim's time, no. No. The U-2, of course, you know, and a couple of the other ones, the Air Force a couple of years ago tried to say that all of the sightings that had been reported since 1947 were developing aircraft. But that's not true, because they were not developing anything like the U-2 or anything like that when the sightings began.
Well, and a U-2 can't perform that way. A U-2 is a very high-flying spy aircraft. It flies at about 100,000 feet off the ground, and it's designed to carry high-resolution optics to take pictures of things on the ground, but it does not maneuver very quickly. This thing would almost weave itself in and out of the wings of this B-36. And it wasn't as though one crew member saw it. You know, 9 of the 10 crew members saw it.
Yes.
Actually, there were 2 craft that did it.
Yes, that's coming back to my mind now. The Pestalozzi. Is that right?
Right. Pestalozzi.
Uh-huh. Of course. I'm sorry. It's coming back into my mind. That was one that Jim was most interested in, because of the multiple witnesses and the strange action of the objects, you see. This is what he was always looking for, strange actions of the objects that were not possible by any conventional source, and multiple reliable witnesses, all telling basically the same statements.
Was he ever interested in the Roswell incidents? Those had to be pretty famous by 1965 anyway.
Well, you see, when we first started, there were just a few of us who were interested in UFOs. You know, 1947, we had a very, very slight interest. We had not formed organizations or anything like that. And I remember seeing in a newspaper that something had been sighted near Roswell. And then the next day, there was the explanation that it was a weather balloon. And so that went out of my mind, and it went out of the mind of everyone who was had any interest in those early days in UFOs. And so that the Roswell incident did not come into public mind as, you know, as a possible important incident until the book was written by Bill Moore, and was it Brad Steiger? Bill Moore co-authored the first book on Roswell.
Right, and now you have Tim Carey and Don Schmidt that are working on it, and they've got the book out, Witness to Roswell. And actually, those two guys have held on to the bone the longest. They've just really, really done an excellent job. We've had them on the program a couple of times. Mm-hmm. And they're as far as physical evidence, they're about as close as this year to getting that hangar open to see actually what did crash that day in the desert.
Oh.
That could change everything if they get that open.
It certainly could. But the Roswell incident was not in our minds in the 60s at all, because it had been, you know, just about a 24-hour story in a newspaper and then immediately explained by the government. And so we had no interest or even knowledge of Roswell until Bill Moore's book came out.
And it's kind of interesting, because although that book was a great seller, it wasn't until the mid to late 80s that cable TV started getting out in the rural areas, and people who had once lived in that New Mexico area or were traveling through that area were exposed to the fact that there was a crash in that time. And so somewhere in the late 80s, early 90s, a new group of witnesses came forth. You know, in those days, people drove across the desert at night in these old cars that would only do 50 miles an hour, but they didn't have air conditioning. And they also didn't cool the engines very well, so it wasn't like you could just take off across the desert like you do today. You had to travel at night, and there were no freeways. So you traveled two-lane roads, and usually four or five cars in a group. And some of these little groups out traveling from place to place across the desert witnessed that crash up in the sky, and those witnesses are starting to come forward even now.
Oh, wonderful! I'm not too aware of that. That's wonderful. But the witnesses in Roswell, you know, like Jesse Marcel,
he
was finally able to talk publicly, and that's when the Roswell debris crash came out to the public knowledge, when Jesse Marcel opened up and started talking. And we say God bless Jesse Marcel, because that is what gives me faith that the Roswell debris crash actually happened. I'm not quite sure of the other crash there that says that the little entity bodies were with, because I don't know enough about the witnesses that are talking about that, you see. But Jesse Marcel, the father, was one person that I did believe. He had the credentials that I could believe what he was saying was true.
Well, have you ever seen one yourself?
I have seen three, two very startling ones. One was in 1945, even before 1947, you know, Kenneth Arnold, and I don't know if you're interested, but in 1962 I saw what we call the carrier craft or the cloud cigars off the coast of Long Beach, California. And so those two things gave me the interest to keep going in this field until now and beyond, because I saw those two things myself.
And I don't often ask this question, but I just am inspired to ask it. How did seeing that craft, and I take it from your description that it was not just a flash in the sky, that this sighting lasted for minutes and minutes. How did you feel while you were watching the UFO?
Well, both of the ones in 1945 and 1962 were very long-lasting, at least an hour and a half, and more than an hour and a half for the 1962 ones. The one in 1945, I was a school kid, and I was coming home on a bus to my home in Long Beach. It was broad daylight. It was about 3:30 in the afternoon, in a clear sky, no clouds, no smog. It was before smog even, and I saw this very bright yellowish white orb in the sky, and it was about two or three times the size of a daytime Venus. And since the age of nine, I had studied adult books on astronomy. I was very interested in astronomy, and I could not figure out what this thing was in the northeast sky. And so I got off the bus and I walked backward watching this thing in the northeast sky. And and I ran in and got my mother to come out and see it with me, and she said, "Well, maybe it's a part of balloon defenses over Long Beach. You know, the war was still going on, World War II, and I knew that there were no balloon defenses in Long Beach. You know, they were in England, but not in Long Beach, even though we were a port city, and always in danger, you know, of the Japanese in the early days of the war, in fact, of being bombed." And so I watched it for an hour and a half, and it slowly traveled from the northeast to the north-northwest, and then an hour and a half later, it gave off what I say little parts of itself. Little tiny objects came out of the main object, which was cohesive. It was not like a star, a planet, nothing like that. It was a cohesive orb. And these little things caught the glint of the sun in the west, and then they would go up and away from the object. And I told myself, if this thing is a balloon, they would be going down straight, you see.
Yeah, and, exactly.
Straight toward the earth. And I ran in and I got my mother and I said, "Mom, the thing is acting as if gravity is not working right on it." And, you know, I don't know where the words came from, but that's what it was. Gravity was not working right on these little orbs coming out of the main orb.
And she
was cooking dinner and she wouldn't come out and see it again. And I was so frightened. I was frightened and awed by this, that I couldn't go out myself to continue watching. It was frightening.
Now, were the ones that you spotted during the day, were they orbs, were they lit up during the day? Were they shiny? Were they dull in color?
The main orb in the 1945 sighting was yellowish white in color. It was very, very distinct in the sky. And then the little things that came out of it, you could not actually see them. I mean, I had very, very good eyesight. You could not actually see them come out, but as you saw them come out, they caught the glint of the setting sun in the west. That this was in, I think, late June, around June 1945. Caught the glint of the setting sun, and you could see them as they traveled up and away from the object.
And were they
but
going
then, of course, they, it was so high, and they were so tiny, that I lost sight. You know, you'd lose sight of them.
Sure.
But there were about 16 or 20 of these little objects that came out of that while I watched.
Were there
and
any,
that, to me, was a carrier craft.
Were there any Air Force planes or anything that came out to meet them? Was there any kind of study or news story or anything acknowledging that they were there?
No, of course, I thought, well, this will be on the radio, and it will be in the movie, it will be in the newspaper. And so I told some of my friends what I had seen, and they laughed at me. And I listened to the radio, trying to find out if anybody else had seen and reported this thing, and read the newspapers, and nothing. Nothing. I saw no planes, no. This was very high in the sky. I have no idea how high it was. But if it was a carrier craft, it was extremely high.
Like 50,000 feet or 100,000 feet? Or
I would think on that order, 50,000 perhaps.
Hmm.
Yes,
and then
because the carrier craft I saw in 62 was very large. And, you know, it was just possibly just thousands of feet above the ocean.
Now,
and
was it gray?
Was just immense compared to what I had seen.
Was it gray in color,
45.
Kind of fuzzy around the edges?
Pardon?
Was it gray in color and kind of fuzzy around the edges, or was it yellow as well?
It was a yellowish-white, brilliant orb, a shining orb that was cohesive. The edges were cohesive.
They did not,
you know, spark out like a planet, like Mars, for example, would look.
Sounds fascinating. Well, I told you this would go quick. That's our first hour gone. What we will do now is we will take about 6 minutes, or actually about 4.5 minute break, and we'll come back after some messages. My guest is Anne Druffel, and her book is called Firestorm. And it's Dr. James McDonald's Fight for UFO Science, and there's a lot more interesting stuff to come. Don't go away. We'll be back after about 4 minutes and 20 seconds of commercials. Foundations of Religion and Science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived the disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. Have you ever thought about owning a telescope? I mean a really good telescope. Well, at the Discovery Store, you can find the world's best telescopes at great discounts and free shipping. They have come a long way, you know. Most of the comets discovered in the last 50 years were found by amateurs. There is no better way to view the sun than with a coronoscope. Trust me, you will be captivated if you ever get to watch the sun through one of these units. Who knows? You might just save the planet. So plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back to X Squared Radio.
Expand consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel.
We're glad you're here, back with us, our guest, Anne Druffel, her book Firestorm. We'll tell you how you can get your copy in just a few minutes. I also want to let you know one of the things about webcast radio. If you have a website, you will understand this. Eventually, you're going to have website woes. Our hosting service has just changed servers, which means the website woes have hit X Squared Radio. That means that the archives are not working properly right now, but we're going to fix that. Don't worry about it. We're going to fix it, and you'll be able to listen to all of these broadcasts at your leisure. Make no mistake about that. Also, wanted to give you an update on The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 3. It is out. You can get it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and if you want an autographed copy, click on the PayPal button at x2-radio.com. We'll get you an autographed copy of that. Buy one there and also buy one at Amazon, because we want to get the rankings of that book up high enough to where we can get some serious exposure. Speaking of that, Tesla Tech is coming up the last weekend of July, so you'll want to make that. That's down in Arizona, I believe it is. I have to look it up on the websites, and I'm not on the web right at the moment, but Tesla Tech. You can find that out, Google it, or put it in as teslatech.com. I'll be speaking down there on Friday night of that weekend. And the weekend following July 4th, this July 4th weekend, we will be at James Gilliland's Ranch in Trout Lake, Washington. We'll be speaking Thursday night there, so that goes Thursday through Sunday. If you have not made one of these Earth Transformation conferences at James Gilliland's Ranch, it's probably the most inexpensive, very high-quality, high-caliber speakers from all around the world. Michal Ledwith is going to be there. Just really, really top-notch presentations there. It is inexpensive to sign up. And I guarantee you, you will not only meet the neatest people, but you'll probably have a very interesting night vision experience watching for UFOs. You can find out about that by going to ESETI, that's E-C-E-T-I, ESETI.org, or you can click on the link at x2-radio.com. An update on the expedition to the North Pole next summer. We have signed on a funding company out of Santa Monica who is helping us to put the last few bits of funding together on that project. looks as though that's going to come together, folks. So stay tuned for that. If you want to find out more about that, get with our friends down at the Phoenix Science Foundation. You can either put that into Google or phoenixsciencefoundation.org, or you can click on the expedition link at the website at x2-radio.com. We will open the phone lines this hour. Anywhere toll-free in the U.S. and Canada, you can reach us at 888-228-4494. And in Canada, we have a toll-free number just for you guys, 877-489-6350. Any place else, on planet, off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us at 530-776-5154. Or 530-776-5185. And we will even accommodate those of you who are using the internet for your long distance. Skype, people, all you need to do is put in BBS Radio. And you Pal Talk listeners, you can reach us at bbsradio_com. We are coming to you live on Sunday nights between 5 and 8 Pacific on the BBS Radio Network. And also through the Steel Eye Media Network, courtesy of our friends at kevinsmithradio.com. In the news, satellite navigation signals already help cruise missiles to find their targets and hungry motorists their way to the nearest fast food joint. Now, it turns out, they can also be used to seek out a valuable resource, water. The fleet of satellites making up the Global Positioning System, GPS satellites, bathe the Earth in a weak microwave signal. These signals bounce off the ground. Their characteristics change in ways that convey information about the soil's moisture content. And there has been speculation for a decade that it might be possible to exploit this effect, and now researchers at the University of Boulder in Colorado have shown how it can be done. All they would really have to do is go back and look up one PhD thesis from 1980, which was finally granted in 2000, on ground probing radar, where radio waves are used to find water and oil and natural gas deep in the ground. And if you need more information on that, email me at bagnew@x2-radio.com, and I'll give you all the information on it. The U.S. Space Agency yesterday placed an order for new spacesuits for the 2015 launch of the new Orion capsule, designed to replace the aging space shuttle and reestablish humans on the moon as part of the Constellation program. The current spacesuits used by spacewalking astronauts were designed for weightless floating in space, not walking on the moon, says project manager for the spacesuit systems at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston. U.S. firm Oceaneering International won the contract, worth up to $745 million, which involves design, testing, evaluation, and production of a suit that can be worn in two different styles. Kind of interesting, if you go back to the old Flash Gordon movies, and even the ones where moonwalkers carried revolvers with them back in the early 60s. Guess what? The suits look just about like that. I saw one the other night on a late-night television movie. Kind of interesting that now it's worth $745 million. I wonder if there's a copyright on that design. Interesting. My guest tonight is Ann Druffel. Her book I reviewed is called Firestorm. It's, a little over 500 pages. The appendix is just stupendous. A lot of very clear copies of the original documents recovered from Blue Book, recovered through the Freedom of Information Act. It is a wealth of information. If you thought you studied really serious data collected on UFOs and you have not read this book, then you're just fooling yourself. You need to get a copy of it. And how can people get a copy of your book?
Well, of course, it's on Amazon.com, and it was it's on my website, www.andruffel.com, you know, if they wish an autographed copy. It's available through the publisher, let's see now, Granite Publications. And it's available in, other sources on the Internet. Some of the sources on the Internet have it available. It's widely available.
Well, that's great. I enjoy it. It's a paperback, but very well done. Good cover, nice red cover, good photography. A lot of paperbacks you get these days, the print quality is really not that good, but this one is top-notch. I highly recommend investing in the book.
Now, Granite published it. There are wonderful editors, Pam Myers and Brian Crissy at Granite Publications, and they were wonderful editors. And when I was writing it, Betsy gave me full access to Jim's files, including personal letters that that no one else has ever seen. And some of them are related in the book. And she gave me access into his colleagues at the University of Arizona at Tucson who were still working there. And they gave me multiple interviews, and other friends, other colleagues had access to through Betsy. And I'm very, very extremely grateful to Betsy McDonald, his widow.
Well, we're grateful that you had the opportunity to write the book and that you're such a good writer and organizer and putting this information together. It really does not come across sensationalized. It's really a top quality documentary. And if you've got a library, even if you are a government scientist and can't risk anyone knowing that you're interested in UFOs, this would be an acceptable book for your bookshelf because it really does stick to the science of discovery, and we appreciate it.
Thank you.
So, Anne, we're talking about Project Blue Book, and on June 7th, I think it was 1958 or 59, or maybe it was in the early 60s, James got the ability or the permission to go to Project Blue Book headquarters, and he had been told that the information he was going to see was not classified. But what actually happened when he got there?
He found he expected, of course, that Project Blue Book, being the official study of the United States Air Force on UFOs, would be a very wonderful organized place. But he found that there were a three-man staff, including a secretary, an assistant to Quintanilla, I remember now, was the one that he met first.
Oh, right.
He was astounded at the lack of cooperation he found at first, and the lack of interest. And he had this whole list with him of cases that he felt were worth exploring. I believe this was in 1966 that he went first.
Right, 1966. I thought I had the year right. But so he gets there, and was everything not classified, or did they withhold?
They showed him just when he asked about a such and such a sighting. They would go and show it to him, because those were not classified. These were the ones that Hynek had found so-called conventional explanations for these very interesting sightings that he had investigated himself and that NICAP had investigated thoroughly and found that they were well worth following up. And then he found out, I believe it was his first or second visit to Blue Book there, that they had classified files, hidden away in a corner. And he asked about those, and he was told, well, we can't show you those, you see. shown the ones that he was interested in, but most of them had been given conventional explanations by J. Allen Hynek, who was a scientific consultant, and a few of the ones that he was interested in had unexplained written on them, you see. But there was no indication that there was any highly scientific study being done by Project Blue Book. And this is what disturbed him so highly, that it was not a scientific study being done there according to what he felt was science.
So it's pretty much the same thing that was going on in the UK. They were just answering the phone and saying, that's nice. And by the way, thanks for the pictures. We'll file them in alphabetical order, no problem. But there was no serious studying going on.
Yes. This is what Nick Pope has said. Is that right?
Yes, this is what Nick Pope said in the UK, is that, mm-hmm. they got, 20 or 30 calls a month, year after year, and they would send people out and gather the pictures and, interview the people, and then they would file it, and that was the end of that. But nothing ever seemed to be followed up on. There was, there was a sighting at, on a Royal Air Force base. Now, you would think that this would pose a clear and present danger, and that whoever was in charge of that Air Force base would be intensely interested on what in the world had landed in the forest outside their air base.
Yes.
But nothing could be further from the truth. They just didn't want to know.
And they had not sent that further up in the UK officialdom?
No.
Was that the Lake and Heath case?
It was just nobody higher up in the government wanted to get their hands dirty with it, and it didn't go anywhere.
I see. Well, at least in the United States, they seemed to go further up, but then they were classified. And we don't know what group or what organization in our government investigated those cases and classified them.
That is so interesting. And what was the Robertson panel?
Robertson panel.
This was a group of highly credentialed scientists that were put together, and they studied the Project Blue Book files for, 3 days or something like that, and they came up with a conclusion on all of this.
Well, you see, this is another thing that disturbed Jim so badly, Jim McDonald. The Robertson panel was supposed to be a scientific study, an official scientific study, of the UFO problem. But what they did was, you can't do that in 3 days, you see. And this is another thing that disturbed Jim so badly. And this is covered in detail in the book also, the Robertson panel. He was so disturbed by the way the government had handled the scientific question of UFOs. And he was never fully convinced, even though we tried to convince him, that there was an official cover-up. Because at NICAP by that time had information that there was an official government cover-up on the very best cases and the very best evidence. But Jim, with his very logical mind, never accepted the fact that there was an official government cover-up of UFO information. And he called it a grand foul-up. What he knew was that when cases happen at a specific military base, you see, that they were covered up there by the people, the military officials in charge of the base, that there was cover-up there. But that he'd never believed that the cover-up extended into the government at large. There's some evidence that toward the end of his life, he was beginning to realize that there was a government cover-up on the very best of UFO information.
You know, I find that exact same thing. When I was in the Air Force, I was stationed at three different air bases, and they all had different commanding officers, who all three had different temperaments, and then they had, you know, division commanders and different flights that had different majors and captains over them. But they pretty much had autonomy, each base. It was kind of run like a military business, almost like a bureaucracy. But when it comes to UFO information, there's no autonomy. There seems to be a central, very clear, seldom misunderstood policy or procedure in place that these base commanders know, and they have to funnel all this information into one receiving agency, and it never comes out of that agency. There is no cowboy base commander out there that shoots one of these things down and then calls CNN.
No. There are official safeguards against military people revealing any information about UFOs that they had seen or investigated. And the same with the that applies to the military. There's I don't know if it's fines or imprisonment, but there are very, very bad things that could happen to military people and government officials who talk openly about UFOs that they know about or have seen themselves. And the same applies to the airlines. I don't think it's even getting better at this time, but from the very beginning, the airline pilots who saw these strange craft, around their airplanes, seen by the passengers as well as the pilots, the ones that tried to report them to the press were told by the government, you do not talk about this, and they were told by the airlines, you do not talk about this or you will be fired. And so the airline pilots at a very early date stopped talking about things that they saw while flying.
Well, I mean, what can you say? Do you come over the intercom of your MD-80, Super 88, and say, passengers on the right-hand side of the aircraft, pay no attention to that shiny disc off of our port side traveling at 7,000 miles an hour. That's not really there.
They don't even say that. In the early days of the sightings, you know, from 47, the airline pilots would inform the passengers, that something, if you would look out, what do you see? They would try that, but two or three times this happened and it reached the press, and then the airlines themselves stopped it. They threatened the people with being fired.
Well, I would
not
think
being hired again by anybody else.
As intense as the competition is between airlines, it might become a new sales tactic. Fly the UFO airlines because we report. Sounds interesting. The Robertson panel, which I think the person that headed it was Captain Edward Ruppelt. He came out and recommended that the subject of UFOs be demystified and debunked under an official media program. Why do you think he went through that effort? I mean, why not just go quiet and not say anything? Why start an actual media program to sell the people on the idea that UFOs just don't exist?
Because after 1947, the term UFO or flying saucer was generally known to the public, and we were aware that these things were being seen and reported. And so the government wanted to shut us up as well as the military and the airlines, you see.
Oh, that's interesting.
They wanted to shut the public up. They wanted to stop the public interest in UFOs. And so that's why the Robertson panel was convened and why they had this, you know, this report given out after the 3 days of intense study. I'm kidding,
successful?
Of course. It's to so that the public themselves would think, well, UFOs are a myth.
Do you think they succeeded? Do you think most people think that UFOs don't exist?
Well, from the very beginning, when polls began to be taken by NICAP in 1957, beginning in 1957, at least 50% of the American public believed that UFOs existed. And close to that number had seen something that they regarded might be a UFO. But, of course, this 50% had not been investigated.
Well, let's say that 50% of the population of the United States are kids. So that puts the adult population of the U.S. at somewhere around 175 million people.
Mm-hmm.
50% to 60% of the 175 million people have actually seen something that they consider to be an unidentified flying object. By my math, that's about 87,500,000 sightings of just the people that are alive in the country right now, just live adults. That is an incredible population of unidentified flying objects in the sky. Do you think the world has been handed an organized, well-funded debunking program for the last 40 years?
Well, you see, the 50% of American public who believe that they have seen something unidentified in the sky they would regard as a UFO, most of these can be explained conventionally with a objective scientific investigation. Because for about 20 or 30 years here, we had a organization connected with NICAP and later with MUFON called Skynet. And I was the project coordinator since 1965 and through the early 1990s. And it was a public reporting and filter center, you see. And we had up to 100 members around Southern California. And the reports would come into my house first from this. I had more time at that time, from the public, you know, referred by the Griffith Observatory and by the police department and other, you know, newspapers would refer these people who had called them and say, he'd seen something in the sky. Who should I report it to? They would refer them to me. So I had collected, many, many hundreds of cases. And I did a study in the 1970s, I believe, or 80s, of these mm-hmm. cases. And I had figured out, and all of these, you see, were investigated as they came into Skynet. We had a very good team of investigators who would go out and interview these people and investigate the sightings as well as they could. So we discovered that about 80% of sightings from the public were explainable by conventional means, because when the sightings came into us, if they were still in the sky at the time they were being reported by the public, I would get the guy on our Skynet map who is closest to the witness in Southern California to go out and see the thing themselves, you see. And this way we were able to identify 80% of sightings that were reported to Skynet. And then 17% of the remaining 20% were too far away or too short-lived sightings to be of any scientific value. but 3% of the sightings that were reported through Skynet were of very possible unidentified objects that were behaving strangely and were very possibly true UFOs.
What about the Phoenix lights, those that happened several years ago at night and then the recent ones? What about the Phoenix sightings?
Well, the first Phoenix sightings, was it about 8 o'clock at night that they occurred? They seem to be perhaps connected with some kind of large triangular craft that was flying in the Phoenix area. You know, a true unidentified flying object. But then, was it about 2 hours later, the Air Force sent up flares trying to duplicate this triangular row of lights. And then the Air Force said, well, what was seen around 8 o'clock were flares. But they weren't, because they did not behave like flares. They did not look like flares. And there were photographs which prove that.
Yeah, flares don't block out the stars at night.
No, they don't.
Now, one of the things that James discovered, and you reveal this in the book, and it's news to me. I mean, it just startled me. I became more a believer in black projects after reading your book, at least the inner workings of the startings of it, than ever before. Was Project Blue Book, the Air Force, was this the only government office that was working on UFOs?
Well, no. You see, it was the one that the government announced officially and publicly that this was the official government scientific study of UFOs. But when Jim started to go there, and, try to get information about cases he was interested in, he realized that there were many, many classified sightings in these cabinets in the back that he was not given access to. And then slowly he learned that there were other, I don't know how far he got into it, but now we know that that all of the parts of the government, the Navy, the Coast Guard, the Army, the Air Force, all had their own official studies of UFOs, plus other parts of the government that were not military.
What happened when James discovered that the CIA was also working on UFOs?
I think he just had indications. He did not have the information that we have now. At the end, toward the end of his life, he had begun to realize that there was this cover-up that was going on in the government. But it's my own opinion that's why the government perhaps helped him end his own life. Because they wanted to get rid of him, he was getting too far into disclosure of what UFOs really were, or how far the government was investigating them. He was making great progress.
Now, who founded NICAP?
It was. Now you see the name escapes me. I'm sorry. This gentleman founded NICAP, and then within a year, he gave over the directorship of it to Major Donnelly Kehoe, who was a famous journalist, a researcher, scientifically oriented. He was a former pilot in the Marines, Major Donnelly Kehoe, and that's when NICAP really took off. And it ended up with thousands of members, about 30,000 members at its height, around the United States and in a few other countries. There were NICAP members and subcommittees.
Now, did you have any political friends? I mean, was there anyone in Congress or the Senate or any of the bureaucracies that were friendly to the mission of NICAP to actually find out what these craft were?
Well, you see, that's where Jim was of great help to us. He knew a few congressmen who were interested, truly interested, in the UFO problems. And he helped NICAP form a UFO subcommittee in the Congress. And they had a very interesting, I believe it was a three-day hearing, a congressional hearing on the subject of UFOs. And they had six of the finest scientific and scientifically oriented speakers who came to give information, including Jim McDonnell and J. Allen Hynek. And there were others, there were four others who gave information, that not publicly, but, you know, they sent their papers in, including Stanton Friedman. And so this was a great breakthrough for the UFO Research Committee, or the civilian UFO research field, this congressional UFO hearing that Jim McDonnell was very instrumental in setting up with the staff of a couple of these congressmen.
What was the result after the hearings when the evidence was entered into the congressional record and these elected officials had some kind of proof that the government was concealing UFO evidence, the very government for whom they work? What was the result when the hearings were completed?
Well, the result was astounding because the hearing was actually produced in a book by Congress, and it was available worldwide, you know, nationwide, and even people in other countries could get copies of this. And of course, I have my own copy, and I remember reading that, and I was astounded at the scientific information that had been given to Congress by these six scientists and the four others who had sent in papers. But it didn't go anywhere, you see. It didn't go anywhere, because shortly after that, we lost Jim. And once we lost Jim in the field, we were stricken. We were stricken. And the
Nobody
interest in the scientific community vanished when Jim McDonnell died. I mean, the scientific community at large was expressing interest in the subject. But after Jim died, the scientific community at large lost its interest or hid its interest. And we were left again with individual scientists who were interested and who worked with civilian researchers. But nothing it was when Jim was alive.
We're not too much different now. I mean, now we have C-SPAN. Now we have, you know, 24-hour news that people who really want to stay informed can watch. But in 1967, when these hearings took place, they didn't televise this stuff. They didn't put it on the 6 o'clock news or the 11 o'clock news. And the general public, unless they had access to books or went to conventions or happened to be involved with someone who was in NICAP, they had no idea what was going on up there.
That's right. It was not given wide publicity in the press, you see. It was in the press, all right, and people knew about it if you watched the news avidly, but it was not like it was on the net. But now we have many more scientists who are interested in the UFO problem, and they're a little more open than they were before. They can be a little more open, although they still have to be worried about their reputation and their careers if their interest in UFOs is made too public.
Well, you know what it's going to take. It's going to take something on the order of global first contact, some group of ships, or a ship is going to have to land and have a ladder come down and wait for the cameras to show up and really introduce itself to the world. And even then, people are going to see it as a Hollywood stunt. It's just, I don't know what it will take to wake people up. But, you know, that's why we have this radio program and other radio programs, because we search after the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. And at some point we become intelligent enough, or at least open-minded enough, to realize that we cannot possibly be the only intelligent life in the universe, and that this planet upon which we live is a highly interesting and unique orb on the outer rim of the Milky Way galaxy, and there really isn't anything like us for 25,000 light years in any direction. And if anyone was exploring the Milky Way galaxy, this would be a planet that would show up. That is a possibility.
Well, I think what will be needed to for widespread knowledge of UFOs is for our government to announce publicly that the UFO phenomenon is real, that there are unidentified flying craft, possibly extraterrestrial, flying in our skies and being caught on radar and photographed. I think this is what's going to happen, because I don't expect that the UFOs are going to land, you know, on the White House lawn or anything like that, because I think they would be blown up if they did.
Well, I don't think they'd land on the White House lawn either, because there's just no intelligent life there.
Laura Bush is intelligent.
Yes, and nice to know. But you've made a statement a couple of times that there's a possibility they could be extraterrestrial. Is there also a possibility that they could be terrestrial, just not of any society that we're aware of?
That would not be in what I have studied, you know, the last 50 years. I have always hypothesized tentatively that they seem to be possibly extraterrestrial, because they are seen apparently coming from outer space into our inner space. And that, to me, indicates that they are possibly extraterrestrial.
Well, do they stay out there, or is there some place on Earth where they can stay and not be readily detected?
Well, of course, there are the theories and the hypotheses, if you want, that they do have UFO bases on Earth. I have not studied that in any degree, because there aren't any in my area that I could study firsthand. But I know that this is part of the UFO research field, that they do consider that they do have bases under the seas, you know, and in the mountains and other places.
If a base was discovered somewhere on the Earth, would you go?
Would I go?
Yeah.
I would have to know what kind of creatures they were, what their motives were, whether I'd get home safely. I think I would. I think I'd go with a group, yes.
Good. We like the hearts of explorers. Yeah, I don't think
I wouldn't go alone, though.
No, we'd go with a group, at least two or three. Now, were there any official statements that came out from anybody that was credible, other than James McDonald, that offered support that UFOs were real and possibly extraterrestrial? Any official statements that came out?
Official statements? Well, not from the government that I know of. But, of course, J. Allen Hynek, after he quit his job as scientific consultant for Project Blue Book, he became very open, an open scientist who hypothesized that possibly extraterrestrial, or he also indicated possibly interdimensional, which James McDonald never addressed because of his scientific mind would not address the fact that it might be interdimensional.
Well, at first it doesn't make a lot of sense that something corporal could just dissolve from this dimension and go into another dimension in order to travel vast distances across space. But when you study, you know, astrophysics, you realize that no ordinary lifespan would be long enough to travel from one place to another in space, even at the speed of light. You'd have to be able to slip in between dimensions to make the distance.
That's what inspired J. Allen Hynek to indicate that very possibly there was an interdimensional aspect to this. You know, the problems of traveling from planet to planet.
Right. Besides, there's a lot of radiation out there, and most of these craft did not appear to carry enough armor to protect themselves from just the radiation from our star, let alone other stars out there.
Uh-huh.
Now you mentioned Kehoe, and I think he had a cohort whose name was Lore. They were eventually fired. So what happened? Well, first of all, why were they fired?
Well, you see, this I go into detail in the Firestorm about this. There was a board of governors connected with NICAP that was supposed to meet twice a year. You know, I think there were about 12 members, and they had the finest scientists, wonderful, wonderful people on this board of governors. But they did not meet twice a year as they were supposed to, because they were all over the country. And they produced a three-man executive committee on the board, and this was supposed to be able to make decisions regarding a NICAP, about the future of NICAP, even, the three-man executive committee. And
right.
So in 1969, this three-man committee met secretly at night with a secretary called Stuart Nixon, and they decided that NICAP was failing because of financial difficulties, and that they would fire Donald Kehoe and his assistant director of the time, Gordon Lohr, and take over themselves. The executive committee would take over NICAP. So they changed the locks on Kehoe's and Lohr's offices, and Kehoe and Gordon Lohr didn't know anything about this. When they arrived the next day to work, they couldn't get into their offices. They found out that the files of NICAP that had been collected since 1957 were no longer available to them or to NICAP members. They were available to the three-man executive committee. Now, we were all astounded when this happened, and we didn't really understand what had happened. But some of us, like people in the subcommittee of NICAP in Los Angeles, we had become suspicious of some of the people on the board, especially I won't specify, but we had become suspicious that perhaps NICAP had been infiltrated by secret agents of the government. And by 1975 or 85, there was a very intense study that went on for years, including information from the Freedom of Information Act, that the three-man committee had at least two people on it that were secret CIA and FBI agents who had infiltrated into our board, into NICAP's board, and onto this three-man executive committee.
Wow.
And the secretary that, you know, that took the notes at this secret nighttime meeting that demolished NICAP was involved with the CIA, And then another director was appointed who was also connected with either the CIA or the FBI. But, of course, these people always, you know, we went after them, of course. And they said, well, no, you know, we did CIA work a few years ago, or we did FBI work a few years ago, but we're not FBI and CIA secret agents. You see, they denied it.
Sure.
But I learned later in the later 60s and 70s that once you are in the CIA, at least, and probably in the FBI, if you do any work for the CIA or the FBI, you never, never leave them. You are always connected with them. And so we had very good information that at least two members and the secretary about this three-man executive committee were CIA agents who had infiltrated the Board of Governors of NICAP with the intention of destroying NICAP's effectiveness.
Well, were they successful? Did NICAP disappear, or did the
It did not disappear until 1975. It limped on, you see, from 1969 to 1975. And we had the NICAP newsletter from 57 through 69, which was full of the most wonderfully investigated cases, the very best cases that we could find. And it was a wonderful publication. But after NICAP was destroyed, after Kehoe and Lohr had to leave, the NICAP newsletter began just a simple little thing about no new cases, no good information at all. And by 1975, it quit officially.
Now, when did the Mutual UFO Network kind of pick up the slack?
It picked up the slack when NICAP was destroyed in 1969. About 1972, the Mutual UFO Network then was involved just in the Midwest of the United States. It was called the Midwest UFO Network, and it was a very fine, objective civilian UFO research organization. But when we saw that NICAP was virtually destroyed as an effective investigative organization, the Mutual UFO Network, the Midwest UFO Network, became national. And it asked all of us, you know, what should the M stand for instead of Midwest UFO Network? And a lot of us, you know, said Mutual. And so that's how they got the name Mutual UFO Network, which is now, it is now international.
Wow.
It's a very good organization. It has a new director called James Carey, and he's very fine, like the other directors were. It does good work in general.
Well, I know there were a lot of efforts to make the whole UFO idea uncredible. I'm talking incredible. I mean uncredible, the no credulity to it. Mm-hmm. And there were several that were prominent in your book. Tell us about the actions of Dr. Edward Condon.
This was the Condon Committee. You see, in 1966, Jim McDonald, had official grants from several parts of the government for climatology and meteorology research. And he had a friend high up in one of these organizations who got for him a funding, government funding, for what he called a quiet one-man UFO study, you see. And this was official. He was going to get the funding for a quiet UFO study. McDonald was. So the next day, there was a secret meeting in Congress. And for some reason, they decided, no, McDonald's not going to be funded. The government is going to fund a UFO committee, you see, in addition to Project Blue Book. And this eventually became the Condon Committee, what we know as the Condon Committee. And the offer of funding to McDonald was abruptly taken away. Within 24 hours, it was taken away from him. And this, to me, is very suspicious that it happened within 24 hours that Congress decided to establish this government study, which eventually became the Condon Committee. And they chose Edward U. Condon, who was a very prominent scientist, a very fine scientist, at the head. And McDonald at first thought, well, Condon, he's a good scientist. He'll do a good job. But then when they established the Condon Committee at the University of Colorado, it soon became evident to investigators like ourselves, you know, the subcommittees all over the country of NICAP, that this was just another Project Blue Book, you know, under another form, and they were not going to do a very objective study of the UFO phenomenon. And it turned out, you know, to be essentially the same as Project Blue Book. But then am I talking too long?
No, you're doing just
uh-huh.
fine.
And then they produced a publication after, I think it was 3 or 4 years study of the Condon Committee at the University of Colorado. And they went all over the country investigating cases. Some of their investigators came to us, you know, to investigate cases we had investigated in our area. And some of their investigators were very, very objective scientists. And then this Condon report came out, I believe it was 1968 or 69. And the first part of it was Dr. Edward U. Condon's conclusions were in the very front of the Condon report, and it said that UFOs were not worthy of scientific study.
Wow!
But McDonald, you see, he obtained one of the very first copies of the Condon report, and he was the first one that we know of to read the whole thing. From page to page, cover to cover, and he discovered that hidden within the text of the report, after these conclusions, that there were one third of the cases that the Condon report, the Condon Committee had investigated around the country, were unidentified, unexplained, unknown, and they were objectively presented in the text of the Condon report. And so somehow the scientists on the team had managed to slip these in without Condon's knowledge. Because Condon wasn't interested in any UFO report. He concentrated on what we call the contactees. And in those days, these were the people, you know, that said, well, they'd taken rides in flying saucers.
Oh, yeah,
we're going to Mars,
we'll talk about
like
that.
He concentrated on them, and he gave talks to scientific organizations about the contactees.
We're going to talk about that in our next hour. Right now, we're going to take about 5 minutes of commercials. We'll be back with our guest, Ann Druffel. Don't go away. There's a lot more to come. We're going to talk about contactees and even more amazing things on X Squared Radio. We'll be back after these messages. Our friends down at NRG Resources have introduced the new engine oil technology. TVT 24/7 is the future of lubrication. This is the industry's first environmentally friendly oil additive that not only increases fuel mileage, it reduces engine, gearbox, and transaxle wear to nothing. The other brands fail anti-friction testing in less than 10 minutes under standard testing conditions. TBT 24/7 went more than 24 hours in the test and still did not fail. Get tomorrow's technology today by visiting the online store at X Squared Radio and pick up TBT 24/7 Engine Oil Energizer. There is some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the six-part series is now available for pre-purchase at $5 off. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today. If you have survived the disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. The foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. Thank you for showing up tonight. Sunday night, second day of summer, Eastern Washington State. AccuWindow forecast says darkness is coming soon. Stars will be bright tonight because the wind's been blowing all day. An international smuggling ring that sold bomb-related parts to Libya, Iran, and North Korea also managed to acquire blueprints for an advanced nuclear weapon, according to a draft report by a former top UN arms inspector that suggests the plans could have been shared secretly with any number of countries or rogue groups. The drawings, discovered in 2006 on computers owned by Swiss businessmen, included essential details for building a compact nuclear device that could be fitted on a type of ballistic missile used by Iran and more than a dozen developing countries, the report says. The computer contents, among more than 1,000 gigabytes of data seized, were recently destroyed by Swiss authorities under supervision of the UN Nuclear Watchdog Agency, which is investigating the now-defunct smuggling ring previously led by Pakistani scientist Abdul Qadir Khan. It seems like Khan has risen again. I did want to throw in right here, don't pass up the opportunity to click on the NitroPak banner. Now, you heard the commercial during the series break, but I could tell you that a large portion of our nation has been plagued with snow, with flooded rivers, with tornadoes, and we're now entering the new hurricane season. It will pay dividends that are uncountable in human collateral if you are just a little bit prepared when these things happen. And I don't mean a couple of extra cans of Campbell's. I'm talking about supplies that are designed to keep for years and to weather emergency situations. They're easy to put in a backpack. Throw them in an old book bag that your kids don't use anymore. Put it in the hall closet by the front of the house. And when you have a disaster happen and you never know what form they're going to come in, you can grab that bag, you can get out of the house, and you've got a little bit of cash, but you've got three meals, some water, and a pair of tennis shoes that at least you can survive in some comfort. Without those bare necessities, people, you are nothing more than a third world refugee in some of these situations. So we want you to click on that NitroPak banner. Yes, we do make a little commission off it, folks, but listen, we researched emergency supply companies for months, almost a year, before we found one that was worthy of the listeners of this program. So do yourself a favor, save up a little money, or if you have a little extra cash from your government rebate check, it would pay you to have some emergency supplies on hand. In the old Boy Scout handbook, the motto is, be prepared. They say that for a reason. Last thing in the news, call it biological alchemy. Specialist pancreatic cells that secrete digestive enzymes have been converted directly into insulin-producing beta cells. Meanwhile, epithelial cells, these are the cells that line your mucous membranes, like your nose and your mouth and the back of your eyes. In fact, epithelial cells from the back of the eye have been coaxed into becoming a versatile new type of stem cell.
We have a caller on line three.
This is done by infecting cells with viruses stuffed with transcripted genes. The viruses do the work for the scientists in making these new types of cells. The cures for many of the world's most crippling diseases is just around the corner. Now, instead of treating the body with drugs, you will just receive new genes to replace the deficiency. Who knows? They may even find a way to stop aging, baldness, and even obesity. It would be a heck of a market for that, and it would be a good thing, I think. I think we have a caller on the line. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from, please.
How you doing? This is Ramon from New York.
Hi, Ramon. Do you have, we have our guest tonight, Ann Druffel, and she's on the line with us. Do you have questions or insights for us?
I do have a question.
Okay.
My question is, since Roswell, 1947. What are the statistics and what is the growth rate of reported sightings?
What is the what of reported sightings? I'm sorry, you broke up just a little bit.
Oh, sorry about that. How many sightings per year since 1947 has it been growing since reported sightings?
That's a good question. And how many sightings per year, and does it continue to grow?
Oh. Well, I'm not a statistician. In 1947, that they trickled in at first, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then they began to flood in the 1950s. And that's when the organizations began to be formed. The civilian UFO research organizations began to be formed in the 1950s when the trickle became a flood. I think it's still a flood. if you see the statistics put out by Mutual UFO Network.
Right.
They vary according to states and according to nations. But if they access MUFON.org, I believe it is, Ramon can get an idea of how many sightings come in from each state. But I wanted to warn him that the sightings, these are not fully investigated sightings. Like we did at NICAP, we didn't release sightings until they had been thoroughly investigated, and we could determine whether or not they were very possibly true UFOs or conventionally, understandable phenomena.
Okay. My last question is, how many different ported species of aliens have people reported to you?
Well, you see, that's a problem that's very it's a difficult problem for me to address because I do not accept the fact that actual physical aliens are abducting humans onto physical UFO craft. I've written a book called How to Defend Yourself Against Alien Abduction, which gives 9 ways that so-called abductees or experiencers can fend off and get rid of the creatures that are harassing them, usually in an altered state of consciousness. But according to, other... could you call them researchers or investigators? They say the 57 types of creatures have been reported, which if you read How to Defend Yourself Against Alien Abduction, you will see that in every culture around the world, down to the millennia, various cultures are describing creatures that kidnap or harass human beings in altered states. And my impression at this time now, my hypothesis, is that the current so-called UFO abducting alien is actually a interdimensional phenomenon that has been harassing the Earth for millennia. The
wow.
Muslims call them jinns. The Celts, the Celtic people call them fairy folk. They're called by different names in every culture, but it's an interdimensional phenomenon that in the United States and in other parts of the Western world presently is presenting itself as physical abducting aliens from physical UFO craft. It's a deceptive phenomenon.
Interesting. So, actually,
thank you.
Thank you, Ramon. So actually, the abductors could be Earth residents just in another dimension, just on the other side of the next millimeter of space.
Yes, if you read the historical and, well, legendary information from Europe and from the UK and from Ireland, I'm sorry, the question.
Well, it's just that you know, you have another dimension just right on the other side of your eyelids, it seems.
This is what has been historically indicated by academics who have studied this phenomenon, this harassing phenomenon. The Muslims in the Quran, it's called the third order of creation. And according to the Quran and according to Irish legends and legends from other countries, this order of creation, an intelligent order of creation, is interdimensional. And that after God created the angels, this is, you know, religious concept, he created the second order of creation, which are called jinns and fairies and things like that, and they were given the earth to live around and under. In other words, in dimensions connected with the earth, which is not our physical space-time. And then the third order of creation, the humans, were created, and we live in the physical space-time connected with the earth.
Wow.
I mean, it's all explained in the book. It's a lot of academic.
I'm going to have to read that one next. You know, any time you get investigating UFOs, whether if you go to a convention. Last year, I spoke about the North Pole expedition we have coming up next year at the Bay Area UFO convention, which was put on by Victoria Jackson, just a wonderful lady, but plagued with health problems. Magnificent event, just great. Met a lot of wonderful people, and there does seem to be two general genres of UFO enthusiasts out there. One is dedicated to getting the government to release what information they know about UFOs, the fact that the craft are real, that they come from other worlds or other galaxies or even other star systems. And the other is dedicated toward the interaction between the alien beings and regular human folk. And the two cross over very little. One is more scientific and the other is very esoteric, almost artistic and into very metaphysical powers and blessings and all kinds of things like this. Not to, you know, degrade them whatsoever. But how do you, and as a UFO researcher and documentarian, how do you keep it straight? How do you explain or understand people who had a very personal experience with an alien being, whether it's off-world or not off-world or interdimensional? They've had an experience. How do you deal with that?
Well, you see, I separate the experiences which are described as harassing from the experiences which are described as beneficial or spiritual. I don't know about the spiritual experiences, but I have studied in depth the harassing experiences called abduction, where human beings apparently are taken aboard a physical UFO and harassed.
All right.
Maybe even taken, hybrid babies are made from them. You know what I mean.
Sure.
There seem to be three types of contact with so-called entities. There are the kind of contact or sightings involving entities which I will accept as physical, taking place in full waking consciousness. And these are the cases where UFOs are seen to land in isolated areas and seen by, you know, one or two or three witnesses. But then the entities come out of the craft and, you know, they're seen gathering soil samples and things like that. But when they detect that they are seen by the witnesses, they get back into their craft and zoom off. You see, there is no contact, no harassment at all. I will accept that part, that type of an entity contact, if you want to call it contact,
okay,
as possibly very real. But then there are the harassing abductions, which I consider as I described in my book, they take place in altered states of consciousness. It is not full waking consciousness. And they are... I hypothesize that it is an interdimensional phenomenon that lives on the earth with us that produces this, the deceptive, shape-shifting, harassing type of phenomenon. And then the spiritual interventions, I haven't studied at any length. I don't know much about those.
I mean, some of them are fairly well documented. Well, you don't want to talk about Muhammad, but there have been Americans there. In the, let's see, 1820, spring of 1820 was Joseph Smith, who had a multiple visitation by a single angelic being who gave him specific information, repeated it three times, and from which he felt that he should form a new church, which... You know, may or may not be controversial to some people. I don't really care or know, but the idea that interdimensional beings, physical beings that you can touch and feel and talk to and feed, can move between dimensions and step into our world and then step back out of it is completely plausible and recorded throughout history, all the way back to the Stone Age, if you can find cave drawings. There's all kinds of evidence, but there's also evidence of the number one kind, where craft come, people get out, some are in suits, some are not in suits, some teach how to plant and do husbandry and teach medicine and mathematics and architecture and even language, and then leave. But that second type, that harassing type, the type that monkeys with the genetics or abducts women and implants fetuses or takes their eggs and, you know, creates hybrids. That is, to say it is a multi-billion dollar industry in the world would be an understatement. There's a huge current of energy in the human community with this second type. And this is the type you've done the most research on. So what have you found in your many, many interviews? What is a common thread that people bring up in this kind of contact with otherworldly beings?
The common thread, you mean the harassing, abducting type?
Yeah.
The common thread that I seem to have found is that the person who sees these creatures is awakened from sleep suddenly, you see, and these creatures then are seen or detected, there's a lot of evidence that these people really do not wake up into full waking consciousness to see these creatures, but that they are in an altered state of consciousness, which seems to them so real that they presume that they are fully awake when they see the creatures. But the creatures, you know, are seen coming through the wall, and the experiencer is perceives him or herself as going through the wall with the creatures, well, this cannot happen in our physical space-time, but it could happen in another dimension, you see.
I see.
So that's a common thread there that I found.
Now, I've in just what little experience, and I haven't interviewed anybody, maybe one or two people, and some of those interview films are available at our website, x2-radio.com. People who have had some kind of experience with an alien, and we just interviewed them on film and put it on there with their permission. And they send their friends there and just, hey, this is an experience that I had. But one thing that I find quite common is that there's some communication handed back and forth, almost as though the aliens come and provide special information that's just for that person, like some kind of invention or some kind of declaration that needs to be made, or some kind of special knowledge that they have to have to solve a problem with energy or with health or something. It seems like there's a download, like an exchange of information. Do you find that common, Anne?
I have not investigated a lot of those cases, but I agree that creatures such as angels can appear to human beings to give information. Or people that have, you know, passed on into the other world and come down from heaven and give information to a human being. I accept those. I accept those kinds of experiences as very possibly real. Angels and saints giving special information to people. But those are very different from the harassing, abducting entities.
Sure they are. Yeah, I see that too. One of my neighbors, his name is Granville Angel, and he is a psychologist. And for a long time did workplace counseling. And one day, and I'm going to say he was in his mid-40s, a woman came into him for some occupational counseling and coaching. And under hypnosis, she revealed a very moving interaction that she had with an alien craft. Well, this is the first experience that Granville had with this kind of revelation by somebody, this kind of interaction. And it really took him by surprise. He started doing a little bit of research, and it wasn't long until he got a second case and then a third. And then somehow it moved him in such a way he decided to hang his shingle out and say, if you've had an experience like this, because this is a small town in North Carolina, come and see me. And he just got covered up. Hundreds and hundreds of people came to him, and he accumulated an incredible database, all of which, of course, is confidential. But he does share typologies and methodologies that literally hundreds of people had extremely common situations. And these were school teachers, policemen, engineers, doctors. Just some were childhood experiences recalled, and others were adolescents, and some were pretty recent. But it was amazing, he said, how many people had some kind of, just the way you describe it, just on the other edge of sleep or in between those sleep and wakefulness realms, this contact seems to be made. But many of these people had physical evidence on them that something had in fact happened. They had incisions. They had, in one case, there was an implant, an actual metal device that was put inside this person in their sinuses. So there's some very strange stuff going on out there, Anne.
Yes, there are many strange stories by fully rational, productive, honest individuals. The majority of abductees, in fact, are productive, honest individuals. And I've, you know, I've studied at least 600 cases of those here in Southern California. But you have to separate the ones where the experience is harassing or abducted, or you know, or an abduction, with the ones where a kind of being comes and gives information in a beneficial, beautiful way to a person, where there is no harassment. You see, I think we have to separate the two experiences.
Sure. Now, is
but I don't know how you do it, of course.
Well, is there a
because
common
there's
thread
no
by race?
There's a very little scientific evidence left. And as far as implants are concerned, I discussed this in How to Defend Yourself Against Alien Abduction. I have a good friend, Berthold Eric Schwarz. He's a psychologist, a psychiatrist, a parapsychologist, and a ufologist who lives in Florida. And his hypothesis, very tentative, is that implants are not, technical instruments left by physical beings from physical UFO craft, but what we call apports. And apports appear during parapsychological experiences in altered states. Like in seances, things can appear on the table, or in very emotional states, sometimes an apport can appear to a person that is very meaningful to them, but it comes from another dimension. It doesn't come from our physical space-time. And so Bert's idea is that implants are apports rather than, you know, physical pieces of machinery left by physical entities from UFOs.
Well, I mean, they make an incision, or they go in with a pair of tweezers and they pull it out. So it's a real thing.
Well, yes, apports can appear within a body, within the human body.
Wow.
According to Bert's hypotheses.
Well, in James McDonald's research, did he ever find any proof that there was a breeding program going on between aliens and humans?
Well, he was aware of just two abductees, Antonio Villa-Boas in Brazil, and three, Betty and Barney Hill in Massachusetts, you see. And he was very interested in the Betty and Barney Hill case. He made friends with Betty. He interviewed them. And he was very interested in finding out what had actually happened to them. Had they actually been taken aboard a UFO? And he started to try to get scientific proof of this. And he contacted a military base that was somewhere near where their abduction had occurred. And there he found he was given the fact that the radar from this military base had detected an object in the sky in the area where Betty and Barney Hill had first detected the UFO. But that was the only information that he could ever gather about abductions.
Wow.
He died in 1971, you see.
Well, did he find any evidence of corpses or body parts or other physical, say, biological evidence that any aliens had, in fact, been in contact with humans?
No. No, you mean like the ones that the government are supposed to be hiding?
Yeah, like those.
Uh-huh. No. No, I don't think any of us have ever seen anything like that.
All right.
Or gotten any proof that these exist, just statements from witnesses, some of which are very reliable people.
Sure.
But I would have to see, you know, the alien bodies in order to accept it. I'm that dubious.
Well, I'm with you on that. I mean, you noted in your book something that I observed back in 2006 when I first went to my first convention and started meeting people, and that's that contactees are almost without exception after two things, publicity and profit. Have you found that this has changed at all over the years?
Well, I think that the contactees are very different from the so-called abductees and experiencers. The contactees wanted to tell everybody that they had seen aliens from UFOs, that they had been taken for rides, that they had these long philosophical and sociological discussions with these aliens, and that in general it was a very pleasant experience for them. And of course, they had whole conferences in which the contactees told of their various experiences. But then the abductees were very reluctant to talk until they found someone who would listen to them objectively, you see. But I have been thinking about this the last two or three years, and I just wonder, because the interdimensional phenomenon, which is described in academic and historical and legendary accounts down through the centuries from every culture, I lost.
Well, it was something you were thinking about over the last two or three years about people.
Yes,
who had
yes. This interdimensional phenomenon is described by all cultures as deceptive, shape-shifting, and occurring in an altered state. You see. Now, if it's shape-shifting and deceptive, if this is the way that this phenomenon is, if they can shape-shift and are deceptive, maybe they contacted the early contactees as pleasant creatures that took them for rides to Mars and Venus and things like that. You see, but then in the early 1970s, they shape-shifted into different kinds of creatures that were less acceptable,
changed their attitude.
I don't know. You see, it might be that the contactees were contacting the same interdimensional species, but that they had changed their shape and their attitude toward us. I don't know. It's just something that's going around in my mind speculatively now.
Well, I kind of thought if Earth was such a grand and interesting place as we became more and more, well, let's use the word civilized, at least where we started keeping ourselves clothed all the time and considered war to be an abomination instead of a way to glory in heaven, that maybe we became a little bit more of an interesting society. And instead of a few million people occupying the planet, now we have a few billion people occupying the planet. And now we have several hundred satellites floating around our own planet and other planets in our own solar system. In my opinion, we're certainly more interesting now than we were, say, 300 years ago. Maybe the class of being that's visiting this planet is changing. And that it's just a possibility that there's more than one population out there. And maybe the race hasn't shape-shifted, but that there is a race of shape-shifting and deceptive beings who has been visiting the Earth for a long, long time, and which most societies either called fairies or what do you call them? devils.
A jinns.
A jinn, yeah, a mischievous, more carnal kind of being. And then there is this other, more esoteric, much higher thinking, you know, less less violent or even non-violent race. I have heard the names Pleiadians and Arcturians and this kind of race being bantied about for, oh, I don't know, a dozen years or so. What have you found to be, you know, the prominent race of beings that are the mischievous ones? Are they just the grays, or do they come in all shapes and sizes?
Well, you see, according to my research into academic, historical, and legendary accounts of this phenomenon, which, you know, is possibly involved in so-called abductions,
are they usually the grays, or are they, you know, different tall blondes?
It lives on the earth with us, according to academics and historians and legends. It lives on, around, and under the earth with us. In other words, in another dimension connected with our earth. And they are described in all cultures as being both good and evil. Not all of this phenomenon, this race of creature, are evil or harassing. There are good ones and there are evil ones. Like, for example, I believe it's the Quran that described that Solomon was given 8 jinns to help him build his temple. You see.
right.
That's in the Quran.
How about that?
Uh-huh.
How about that?
So, some of them are good, and then others are evil, but they are all capable of deception and shape-shifting.
Well, maybe it has to do with the integrity, the ability of the person who's being contacted to maintain their sovereignty in the presence of another being of a fairly strong will. Most people are not conscious that they're conscious, and they just kind of are blown around by every wind of doctrine. And others are very firm in their conviction or their indoctrination, whichever you want to call it. And still others are just firm in their own sovereignty. They realize that they are their own creators, so to speak, and they're not very easily deceived. So maybe that has something to do with how, at least the methodology of contact.
Well, my study of abductees who are able to fend off and resist the contacts with these creatures, they all seem to be very strong-minded individuals who are fully aware of their own inalienable right to privacy. You see, the ones
very
who
well
are
said.
Abducted and don't know what to do are not as strong-minded or confident in their personalities.
Right. I know exactly.
They're good
what
people,
you're
but
just good people just wandering through this life. Others. Kind of know why they're here, and they know the purpose of life, and they're hard at work about it.
Oh, we would hope that everyone is that way.
Well, they're not. Some people are awake and some people aren't, and it's unfortunate, but throughout history there are very awake beings who want to do evil, and there are awake beings who want to do good.
Oh,
and,
yes.
And both have enemies, as we have seen. So,
yes.
We just live the best way that we can live, help, and believe in the most people that we can believe. I have one of my favorite teachers who said to me, it does not matter how much people love you, it only matters how much you love others.
Ah.
Well, Anne, I know it's been a fantastic 3 hours. I can't believe we've blown through 3 hours again. It's been, seems like 15 minutes. I'm going to recommend again this book, Firestorm, and I'm going to read your other book, How to Protect Yourself from Alien Abduction. What are the other three books? They're not about UFOs or aliens. They're about other subjects. What are they about?
Well, they were all co-authored with a very remarkable clairvoyant that I knew for years. His name is Armand Marcotte. And one of them is Past Lives, Future Growth. And it was his idea, his ideas on reincarnation and the people that he had had come into contact that seemed to be, you know, some reason why they were here because of difficulties in former lives. And then the next one was The Psychic and the Detective, because Armand for years had given counsel and help to sheriffs and police stations all around Southern California and into the Midwest on cases that they had been unable to solve, criminal cases. And then the third one that was just published in 2006 is Standing in God's Light in End Times. And this was Armand's ideas, his predictions in 9 readings that he made during the 1990s about coming end times and the ways that it would affect the earth and human beings. But that he had a more hopeful scenario than a lot of people have. He said that there would be eventually a spiritual intervention, which he did not specify, that would bring about a period of peace to the world in which we would live in an evolved world. And I did research on that, and I came to the conclusion that perhaps what he meant by the spiritual intervention was connected with the prophecies and the events of Fatima in 1917 and down to
the decade. Oh, right, sure, of course.
And that's all in the book. So it's a more hopeful scenario than some people have.
Excellent.
About end times.
Well, Ann's website is simply andruffel.com, A-N-N-D-R-U-F-F-E-L. So we want you to get to that website. We will have a link forever on X Squared Radio, so people can find you, and it has been a great pleasure to have you on the program tonight with us.
Oh, thank you. It's been wonderful. Thank you so much, Brooks.
Oh, you're welcome, and we'll speak another time. Good night.
Good night.
All right, Earth Explorers, that is it for X Squared Radio, June 22nd. June 29th, we are going to have a guest of guests here, so you don't want to pass this up. We're getting into some really neat information. Be nice and be excellent to one another. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.
$5,000 per week take you? Discover the exact details of a simple and proven system that quickly puts $5,000 to $10,000 in many students' pockets every week. What's most amazing is that there are almost no computer skills required, and you can start pulling in cash automatically within just a few hours. We are absolutely convinced that our proven system will create massive wealth for virtually anyone, and we'll prove it. Go to bbscashflow.com now and get all the details. That's bbscashflow.com.